Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 11. Andy, the Beautiful Weed. It must have been sometime after midnight when I was awakened by a loud tapping on the van window. I was parked in the Methodist Church parking lot that overlooks the city, tucked snugly into my sleeping bag. I ducked even deeper into the bag, covering my head, and put one hand on Willow, who had begun to growl. I figured it must be the police checking me out. I had been told by the guys at Sally's not to open the door. "They have to give you notice," Lenny told me. "Don't open the door or get out. Just say, 'I'm sleeping here,' and they have to give you 24 hours to get out." "Richard, Richard, wake up," a familiar voice called out. It wasn't the cops. It was C. "It's me, C," he called out. "Wake up, wake up." I rolled over and opened the latch on the back hatch and pushed the door up. I was greeted by drops of rain and C's face. "Hey, I need your help," he said. "Andy's in trouble. Jake told me he saw him lying in the alley behind the 7-Eleven. If you can, I want to get to him before the police do." "Sure," I said sleepily. "It will just take me a minute to rearrange my stuff." I quickly slipped on my shoes and tossed the stuff from the front seat into the back, and we took off to find Andy. We were racing down the hill across the Warren Avenue Bridge toward the downtown 7-Eleven. "Jake stopped in at the Maple Leaf and told me about Andy," C said. "He couldn't do anything for him, so he walked up to the Leaf to get help. Then I walked up here. It's been maybe a couple of hours now." The windshield wipers beat their steady rhythm as we pulled into the alley behind the 7-Eleven. Andy was still lying there, with the side of his face in a mud puddle. The walker that he had been using was flipped over on its side. "Damn," C explained. "Poor Andy." We jumped out of the van before it had fully stopped, and C knelt down, lifting Andy's upper torso off the ground. "You alive, Andy?" he asked. Who are you?" Andy slurred. "It's C, Andy," C said, wiping the mud from Andy's face. "Damn, Andy, what are you doing here?"
I don't know, Andy responded. I'm just here.
"Jesus, Andy, you're all wet," C continued. "And you smell. Did you pee your pants, Andy?"
"I guess. I don't know.
Andy was floating in and out of focus. C looked up at me. "Richard, have you got any clean pants in your van?" he asked.
"I think so. I'll get a pair," I said, turning and heading toward the van.
"Maybe a shirt, too," C added. "It seems Andy threw up on himself as well." I found a reasonably clean pair of pants and a wool shirt in a pile of clothes in the back of the van. C had already pulled Andy's pants off by the time I got back. He lifted Andy off the ground.
"Can you hold him up while I get the pants on him?" he asked.
I grabbed Andy under the arms and attempted to stabilize him while C wrestled the clean pair of trousers first onto one leg and then the other. Andy was trembling from the cold. Once C got the pants up to Andy's waist, he unbuttoned and removed his shirt, tossing the old clothes aside and slipping the clean shirt on. Then C undid the knotted handkerchief from his own head and wiped the vomit from the edges of Andy's mouth.
"Man, you got bad breath tonight, Andy," he said, chuckling. Then C took off his coat and put it around Andy.
"Let's go, Andy," C said, and we each grabbed him under the armpit and led him to the van. We were moving as quickly as possible, all of us now pretty well soaked from the rain.
"Would you grab his walker?" C asked, as he settled Andy into the van. "Let's take him back to my RV. He can stay there for a couple of days."
We both took a deep breath as we started up the van. I turned up the radio as we headed back to the Armadillo, thinking that this last hour had been so C-ish. Andy was the classic alcoholic. He had been picked up by the police and taken to the emergency room 44 times in a year. They would check him out,
Let him dry out for 4 or 5 hours, then send him back out on the street. Everyone had given up on Andy, except C. Andy was what my psychologist called a weed. As they explained it, we see them every month or so because they are sent out here and they can get in trouble with the rules. How they live and how they survive in this society is amazing. Every time they leave, we wonder if we will ever see them again. We don't really expect them to live. But somehow, they just keep coming back, like weeds in between the rocks on a mountain trail, beautiful and persistent weeds. My shrink's analogy was a compliment of the highest degree. Others would have ended their lives long ago, with a plethora of pills washed down with a pint of whiskey. But Andy never gave up on life. He was truly a weed. Every time something chopped him off at the roots, he would come back. Andy wasn't pretty. He looked like a skinny Andy Rooney. He shook when he drank, but he shook even more when he didn't. He was a querulous sort, complaining about everything when he was forced off the sauce for lack of money or some other reason. Things fell through, he would often tell the few people who cared enough to listen to his story. For Andy, it was a whole lifetime of things falling through. The weather had gotten nastier by the time we arrived at C's RV. It was raining harder and harder, and the wind had picked up. It slammed the aluminum door of the Armadillo against the side of the camper when C opened it. We scrambled to get Andy out of the back seat of the van and get us all into the RV as quickly as we could. "Whoa," I said, slamming the door shut when we were finally all inside. C's two cats, my Lynx and Calico, jumped down from the loft above the front cab and welcomed their master back by rubbing against his legs, meowing loudly. The head of a black man appeared over the front seat. "What's up, fellows?" he asked. "Hi, Brian," C replied. "I see you're in for the night." "Yeah, it's nasty out there," Brian said. C propped Andy up on the seat of the fold-down bed. "I'm going to make some tea," he said, removing dirty pots and pans from the propane stovetop. "That will warm it up in here. Richard, that's Brian up front. Brian, this is Richard." "Nice to meet you," Brian waved. I nodded my head in return. "Brian is renting the front seat for $10 a month," said C, as he looked for a match. "He just got out of jail and needed a place to stay." He found the match and struck it, turning the knob and lighting the stove. "Hey, Brian, what would you think if we had Andy stay with us for a while?" "Maybe he could do the dishes," Brian chuckled. "How about $10 a month for rent, Andy?" C asked. "Let's see," C mused, filling a teapot with water. $10 for first, $10 for last, and $10 for deposit. I'll waive the last in the deposit, but we'll have to check your credit report and your references." "I think the guys down at the liquor store will vouch for him," Brian chimed in. Andy was defenseless at this point. He just laid his head down on the bed. "Let's get those shoes off of him," C said, pulling Andy's leg up the bed and starting the process of unlacing his boots. "Andy's had a tough life," reflected C. "He told me some of it one day when we were both panhandling in front of the 7-Eleven. He's from Texas. Houston, I think," he said. "His dad, who was a drunk and used to beat on him, kicked him out of the house when he was 15. Andy lived on the streets for a while. Houston was a tough town back in the 70s. The boots finally gave way, and C tossed a blanket over Andy. My Lynx jumped up to investigate the newcomer. The knowing feline sniffed and kneaded, then curled up by Andy's neck. The battered teapot began to rattle on the burner. "You want a cup of tea, Brian?" asked C. "No, thanks," came the reply. "I'm going to try to get some shut-eye." He disappeared back down the front seat, now a veritable condo. C got up and picked the teapot off the burner, filled his cup with hot water, and sat back down. He methodically dipped his tea bag in the cup. "Earl Grey, I love this tea," he said. Hey, I found some premium snips in the ashtray just outside the emergency room entrance of the hospital. He reached for a tin can of cigarette butts on the counter. 20 or more, half-smoked. He was picking through the can, looking for the best one. Then he struck a match and lit up. Andy began snoring. I think that Andy's at his best asleep, observed C. He told me once that when he dies, that's just how he wants to go. Just lie down, fall asleep, and die. C sipped his steaming cup of tea with an, ah, that's good, thrown in amidst his memories and reflections. Then he sighed. Andy's got a death wish. He's going to drink himself to death. He's getting worse. He shakes so badly when he can't afford booze. He panhandles for booze money up in front of the Albertsons until he gets enough to buy a quart. We have to get him off the street for a little bit. As Andy's snoring got louder, C rolled his eyes, and we shared a good chuckle. He seems to be going downhill fast, I said. He didn't used to need a walker. He's a strong man, though, C replied, and fiercely independent. I couldn't do what he has done. He slept on the benches down at the ferry terminal all last winter. No blanket, no pillow. They finally kicked him out of there. He slept in dumpsters. He's tough. How old is Andy? I asked. 57 or so, C replied. He told me once he hadn't had a birthday party in 16 years. Yet more people in Bremerton recognize Andy than recognize the mayor. Bus drivers know Andy, and cab drivers, grocery store clerks, doctors, medics, and liquor store clerks. Everyone sort of loves Andy. He is harmless. He never hurt anybody, anytime, anywhere. He told us once that he started out working on an oil rig off the Texas Gulf Coast near Corpus Christi, I think, C continued. They called him Little Andy. You know, sort of that macho man repertoire, that passive-aggressive mumbo-jumbo reserved for the smallest and the most gentle. They used to tease Andy because he liked to read books and write poetry. I tried to picture Andy wearing one of those round metal caps, a sleeveless white undershirt, jeans, and the steel-toed high-top work shoes covered in grease, his muscles rippling as he plied a large wrench to an oil rig bolt in the hot Texas sun. That was Andy then, the same Andy who now panhandles up and down 6th Street on his broken-wheeled walker. At age 20, Andy left Texas and made his way up to the Northwest in stages. First, he hitchhiked to San Diego and then to Mexico, where he sampled the charms of the señoritas in Tijuana until he was out of money and needed medical care. For excessive itching and burning between his legs, C said, if you know what I mean. Andy worked his way north doing odd jobs, as a short-order cook, as a farmhand picking grapes, until he landed a logging job near the Washington coast. Andy was one of those guys who climbed up those big trees and cut off the tops of those giants near the Olympic National Forest, C explained. He'd done that for several years and was making pretty good money for a while. But then one year he worked for a logging company that promised to pay him at the end of the job. He was living in a company cabin and eating company food when with the other loggers. But after 6 months, the company went bankrupt and nobody got paid. He lost the few possessions he had and landed on the street. That's probably when Andy started seriously drinking and he just never stopped. C surmised. Just looking for a little comfort, you know, a little diversion from the pain. The liquor bottle became his best friend, his lover, and finally the only thing he could count on to slow the shaking. Well, do you think he just gave up? I asked. No, C said. Look at him. He's still there, thorns and all. A man like that doesn't just give up. He survives. He told me once that the cops kept rousing him out of the woods and finally got tired of it. As they were walking out of the woods, one cop gave him a baton to the back of the legs and a baton to the stomach. As Andy was lying there, the cop said,
We want you to get out of town and never come back, Andy. Do you get the message?
Did he leave town? I asked.
No, not Andy. He's been beaten up several times.
C described how some teenagers caught Andy one night in the alley behind the 7-Eleven, where we had found him tonight. They'd beaten up on him just for the Friday night fun of it. Andy needed an extreme makeover on the inside. Many of his internal parts appeared to be failing. As he inched his way down the sidewalks of Bremerton, eventually nature would call. If he ventured too far from the Salvation Army or the ferry terminal, he was in no toilet land. 9 banks, 6 mortgage companies, 8 insurance companies, 10 attorney's offices, 3 jewelers, 4 art galleries, 6 antique stores, 2 tattoo parlors, 8 bars, and 2 restaurants make up the business core of the town, and none of them wanted the likes of Andy using their bathrooms. He had tried them all before in his quest to relieve himself, and they had all said no and gave him that look that homeless people know so well. It's a look that says, get out of here and don't come back. So if Andy couldn't find a back alley really fast, he'd pee his pants. C was shaking his head. He told me he'd tried some things, tried to stop drinking, tried different jobs, even tried having a girlfriend. But each time things fell through. He would always lose the job, or the girlfriend would kick him out, and he would hit the bottle harder each time. His life sounds like one of those country songs. My girlfriend left, my dog died, my trailer caught fire, and my truck got repossessed. C sang in his best twang. I laughed. Let me tell you unequivocally that you have absolutely no future in country music. C smiled and brought us back to the subject.
Do you believe in karma, Richard?
Well, I don't know, I replied. No, not really, I guess. I have seen too many bad things happen to good people and too many good things happen to bad people to believe in that.
Well, said C, whether it's just karma or just plain old bad luck, things have just never worked out for Andy. People tried to help now and again, and he'd stay with someone for a day or a week. But he always got kicked out. Now maybe nobody can really help Andy. There was probably a time in those years when just the right person or place would have worked for Andy. Just one break. A person who loved him enough to overlook his flaws. A place where he could blossom and turn into a beautiful rose. We are not born drunks, you know. But none of those good things ever happened for Andy. The rain was now pounding on the roof of the Armadillo, and we sat in silence, listening to the music nature was giving us. I could see C's mind still working. I think I'm going to try to help him, he finally said. Everybody can be helped and can help others. Yes, I'm going to do it. His voice was taking on more and more resolve. I was a little mystified. You're some kind of a saint, I said. He just gazed into space, the way he often did. I finished up my tea and glanced down at my Timex. Wow, it's 4:30 in the morning. I've got to get some sleep. I stood up, stretched, and yawned. Well, thanks, Richard, for helping get Andy, said C. You bet. Willow had fallen asleep on the camper floor. I carefully picked her up, put her inside my coat, and headed out the door into the driving rain. I tried to sort out my jumbled feelings as I drove back up to the church parking lot. What was all this about? I didn't feel sorry for Andy. Andy was just Andy. And Andy didn't need judgment or pity, mine or anyone else's. Andy was somehow able to take the good and let the bad pass by. Most of us live a lifetime without learning how crucial that can be, or how to perform that simple magic. Doubtless there was a lesson for me here. If so, it was a hard one for me to embrace. But more than Andy, it was C whom I couldn't quite understand. His way of pulling strays in out of the rain. What made a man do that? Hell, even my family wouldn't do that for me, even clean and sober. It was inconvenient for them.
But that was a place I didn't want to go. Dwelling on that piece of grief would only get me into trouble.
That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright 2009. It is read with the permission of Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on the bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. The bookshelf is produced and edited by Vern Windham. I'm Jeff Hazen.